to www.integralnaked.org.
Going back to your question about how does one cultivate this, I keep coming back to this idea of an experimental ethics, that one really does test it out for oneself. And I think one thing that I have not seen talked about anywhere are the levels of subtlety to which ethical experimentation and living can be taken, and I think probably have to be taken by anyone who really wants to mature towards the fullness of their being. For example, if we take something like what the Buddhists would call right speech, or in our tradition is, you know, don't lie, etc. Well, you know, okay, don't tell lies. Well, that's simple. Okay. Yeah. But it's not simple.
No, it's not simple at all, especially that one. Yeah.
I've been working on this for 20 years, and what I find is, yeah, there's barely a day goes by that I don't open my mouth, and 1 second later I realize, wait on, that's not true. I didn't. So I find a very interesting exercise to really try to practice telling the truth. Now, and here I'm defining truth in a very particular way. I'm saying what is congruent with my experience.
Yeah.
And to do that involves something very interesting. And the best advice I've run across, and the most succinct, I think, was the Buddha's, who said, say only what is true and helpful.
Yeah.
And we all know some people who've gotten one half of that. You know, Fritz Perls with told the truth, but he sure didn't say, always say what was helpful. Yeah. We know. And the truth can be used as a weapon, as we all know.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you this for your own good.
Yes, you're good.
So I find that, for example, truth-telling becomes an extraordinarily demanding yoga in which I have to be really aware of what I'm experiencing in each moment in order to mold my words to precisely, or as precisely as I can, mirror my experience and do it accurately.
And particularly if you're going to cut that with telling what is useful also.
Exactly.
Because these are sometimes contradictory. That's the dialectic of being true and useful. Diplomacy, in other words, is being able to tell truth in a way that's not harmful.
Yes.
And sometimes twisted into lines, you know, that it's... useful and truth are sometimes hard to mix.
Well, yeah, now, okay, that's a good way of saying it. They're hard to mix, but I've come to the conclusion that this is one of the arts of life. That is, how does one tell the truth in a way which is truly helpful? And I have a hypothesis. I'm reluctant as yet to call it a law.
Not yet a law.
But I hope long after I'm dead it will come to be known as Walsh's law, universal law or something. That it is possible to tell the truth about anything in a way which is helpful.
Yes.
Now, doing that is a very demanding skill, which I don't pretend to have mastered.
Yeah.
But I am very interested in learning.
Yeah.
And I find it is a very demanding and honing practice. Because it really does demand that I be present in each moment, I know what my experience is in each moment, I be aware of what I'm saying, and that I try to be as precise as possible with my language.
And for it to be useful, you have to be aware of what the other person is feeling, what they're seeing at that moment, what is congruent for them, and what will be useful for them in order to be useful. It's an exercise in taking perspectives.
Very good, yes. Okay, that's a nice addition. And there's also the existential context that we never really know.
Yeah.
We don't know for sure what's best. So we're always operating in our truth-telling and our ethics in an arena of ultimate uncertainty.
Sure.
So to act with this intention of doing the best demands optimally that it all be held in the existential context of not knowing, of ultimate not knowing, of great mystery, of radical mystery, unqualified mystery.
And not confuse that with make no judgments at all.
Exactly. And that, of course, that radical mystery, that not knowing the bodhisattva has nowhere to stand, etc., that is a wonderful antidote to a dangerous grandiosity or certainty or moralism that lays down one's own morality on top of other people.
Right.
And it's amazing how much of the world's suffering is created by people who think they know what is good for other people.
I'd also like to add a footnote to that. Because a lot of people then take what you're saying, which is absolutely true, I believe, and then use it again. They misunderstand it slightly to turn it into, therefore, we shouldn't be making judgments at all. We have no discernment. And as a matter of fact, this radical non-dual ground has its own radical certainty. It is self-knowing, self-liberating, self-validating, self-authenticating. So to the extent that one is really plugged into this mystery, there's no doubt about that mystery. It's kind of a radical certainty that underlies what's arising. It's also the basis of both everything from the Cartesian to the Vedantin notion that you can't doubt the fundamental nature of consciousness itself. There's a certainty to that. You might call it capital C certainty or meta certainty or trans certainty, but it's not a wobbliness. I mean, Zen is very simple. Stand, sit, above all, don't wobble. And so I think it's really important to do that because people really misinterpret that mystery as wishy-washiness. And it's a self-validating, self-authenticating, not doubtable fundamental ground of existence.
Yes, that's very good. Now let me ask you, does that certainty, though, in any way carry over into a certainty
none
about the
all.
Manifest?
None yes, whatsoever.
Yes. That's
but that's the point. None whatsoever. In other words, you can't say, therefore I can't make judgments.
Yes.
That's a judgment.
Very good. Very
See,
good.
That's the thing. It's neither judgment nor no judgment.
Yeah.
And this radical no judgment has been used to say that you can make no judgments. And then there was a confusion of absolute relative truth, or confusion of non-dual with its forms. It doesn't carry over at all.
Yes,
great. That's the point. So, or it carries over to both sides, however you want to look at it.
Well, but, it is non-dual.
But it's non-dual, exactly.
Yeah. That's the trouble with non-dual. It's so damn non-dual.
It's the name non-dual, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to just carry this ethical experimentation to the stage further, because as far as I can see, and I just don't find this talked about, this ethical practice can be taken to indefinitely subtle levels, and it so seems like it's a lifetime challenge, and that it's intimately connected with other practices. For example, if we think of awareness or consciousness or sensitivity, that to the extent one is unethical, one generates fear, greed, anger, jealousy, all the qualities which agitate and disturb the mind, as Jack Kornfield, the meditation teacher, says, it's very hard to sit quietly after you've spent the day in lying and stealing and cheating people. On the other hand, ethical behavior reduces the amount of guilt, fear, anger, jealousy we have, cultivates positive qualities like love and joy, and calm and peace. So the mind does tend to still. It becomes more sensitive. One can concentrate better. Perception becomes clearer. One can see increasingly the little ways in which one is unethical. So ethicality becomes part of an integrative, mutual facilitating of spiritual, contemplative, and psychologically beneficent qualities in a positive cycle, so that it fosters, for example, meditation and contemplative awareness. Contemplative awareness makes one aware of ways in which one is being unethical at more and more subtle levels. So now you can move ethics into a whole nother arena of thought. That is, you just begin to notice when unethical thoughts arise or unethical motives. And so now you can work at that level. And I think one of the things that demarcates development is a process of increasing interiorization, increasing subtlety, and that not only does one experience become more subtle and sensitive, and the issues which arrive become more sensitive, but one can also work at a more subtle and sensitive level. In fact, I think it's imperative. And so for people who are interested in this kind of work, as a result of this ethical experimentation, one finds that it is intimately related to one's contemplative practice, one's spiritual maturation, one's sensitivity, and of course, one's relational sensitivity and empathy.
Yes, I agree entirely, and I'm going to add a footnote on another area and just sort of not to detract from this, but it reminds me again that the wonderful trinity of the good, the true, and the beautiful, that what aesthetics, people don't usually think of it this way, but your capacity for truth perception increases to the capacity that your aesthetics and ethics also, they go together. They tend to be aspects of that same unfolding. Now, for us, they're versions of the quadrants, for example. The quadrants are present at each level. So higher levels of development have four quadrants. They have the good, the true, and the beautiful. There's a higher good, a higher true, and a higher beautiful, a higher aesthetic capacity, higher ethical capacity, higher capacity for truth discernment. And so to the extent that you are increasing one of those, like the virtues, they're are interwoven, and to increase one tends to drag others along. So I find that the more I'm in an aesthetic environment, and the more I'm ethical, the greater my capacity for truth pursuit, and then whether contemplative or otherwise. And if you think about any of the great contemplative monasteries or architecture, for example, which, according to the critics, is people so withdrawn and not even aware of this world, the most beautiful art, the most beautiful landscaping, comes from the contemplative traditions. Whether it's a San Rock Garden or any of the cathedrals, Notre Dame or Chartres, for example, or the Illumined Manuscripts of the Medieval Ages, and a heightened aesthetics and a heightened ethics comes with heightened capacity for truth perception and spiritual contemplation. So again, I think this is a very important things that go together. They're interwoven.
Good.
And it's a good reminder that we're not just simply doing ethics over here and then doing spirituality over there, and then doing truth pursuit, and then doing mental function. They're really interwoven in a very fundamental and important way. We were talking about some of the ways that you help people kind of intuitively feel into the ethical thing to do as a way to realize that they are, in a sense, balancing perspectives, doing the ethical thing, the right thing at that moment, that they know how to do it, or they can learn how to do it. But that's also the difficult thing, too. We were talking about, for example, with men and women, knowing what the other person's perspective is necessary to do the useful thing. And if you can tell the truth and useful, taking perspectives into account is crucial in any ethical decision.
Yeah.
So what are some, let's just a little more pragmatics of the ethical side of the street for people. Are there any other sort of things that come to mind along that in terms of practical suggestions that you found help for people? And what is an ethical act? What does betterment for other sentient beings mean?
Well, there are some really important basics, and that is that I think it's really important to do one's psychological work. I mean, this may seem very elementary, but to the extent one is ground up by guilt or fear or jealousy or anger, any of those things will drive one to unethical behavior in the first part, and they're so agitating and consuming and disturbing that they very much get in the way of one's intuitive capacities and one's capacity to feel what's appropriate. So,
and that's part of the general recommendation, is there are two recommendations in terms of practice. One was the general one for what you can do to basically help your own development and well-being in general, and that would spill over into ethics. And then there were practices that focused specifically on the training of ethics and things you could do for that. Mm-hmm. And so watching one's general psychotherapeutic stance, if you will, and shadow elements would certainly be a general recommendation.
Certainly a general one, yes. In terms of, let's say, draw on some of the classic practices for cultivating compassion, for example, have traditionally been regarded as essential to ethical maturation.
Such as?
Well, let's take a very simple one and then move to a classical one. I particularly like exercises which take the experiences we have in daily life that didn't come up anyway, and then looking at ways in which we can judo them into useful practices. That's effectively transforming life into karma yoga or awakening service. So if we look for a compassion, empathy, ethic-generating practice in daily life, one that I find very powerful and which is certainly recommended in some traditions is to take times when we're suffering somewhere. Perhaps when we're ill or have suffered a loss of some kind. And then, well, let me give you my own experience. Usually when I get sick, I spend the first couple of days thinking, oh, how awful I feel. Why me? Why has this happened to me? What have I done? And then after a couple of days, I have this blinding insight into the obvious that, gee, there are a lot of other people who are sick in the world. And an awful lot of them are a lot sicker than I am. And when I have that totally obvious recognition, then the experience starts to shift or be recontextualized and can now be used not for the generation of poor me and the cultivation of my egocentricity, but rather for an empathy with the suffering of others, a recognition of the scope of that suffering, and out of that comes compassion. So basically the practice is to take whatever pain I'm experiencing in the moment to use that to remind me of all the people who are suffering similarly, and in many cases much worse, and then simply to hold their suffering in mind. And the wonderful thing is that to the extent we open to the suffering of others, then compassion arises spontaneously. And that's nice, because I think I certainly had the idea, and I think a lot of people have the idea, that we have to somehow make the compassion happen. And the wonderful thing is to find that the mind will simply create that compassion of itself when awareness is opened appropriately to the suffering of others. And I think actually that brings us to one of the most important things I've learned about the mind, and that is when we foster awareness, we discover that the mind is a self-healing, self-actualizing, self-transcending instrument. That if we give the mind the right conditions, it will grow and heal and self-transcend and awaken.
Yeah.
And that is extraordinarily valuable, because most of us live with the presupposition that our minds are our enemies.
Yeah.
Basically, it means that people are living in perpetual conflict with their own minds.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's a recipe of suffering. So that's a general principle, but the specific principle here for this practice is to take our own experience, any experience of suffering, to use that as a reminder of the suffering of all the people who are experiencing similar or worse pain, and to open to their pain and thereby allow compassion to arise. Now, that's very useful, because it becomes a kind of life judo in which the suffering that we're going to experience inevitably becomes now the means for our cultivation, awakening, and ultimately for the service and relief of suffering in others. Because as soon as that compassion arises, we are moved spontaneously to try and do something about it. So that's an exercise which I find...
And again, it's perspective stretching. It's mind stretching, isn't it? And that's what just continues to fascinate me about it. And I'll give you a little riff on it, just as we were talking about earlier today, the phenomenally successful novels Left Behind by a Christian fundamentalist who has basically written a series of novels about the rapture and what's going to happen. And what's so fascinating about that is the degree of relish with which he describes the suffering of non-believers. And so what you find is that everything he's saying is right about the mind spontaneously wanting to help others if it perceives them to be of its own kind.
Good qualifier.
And so with somebody ethnocentric, their own kind, they will do whatever they can to help. But if you're perceived as, you know, on the bad side, evil side, the other side of the fence, there's a certain relish in the suffering of them. And even if you picture and contemplate it, you're happy to see them gone because you've threatened it. So the mind will spontaneously reach out to those within the orbit of its own perspectives, which is why growing perspectives is so important. Being able to take other perspectives, first, second, third, fourth, fifth person, and so on, is absolutely crucial to this whole endeavor.
Yes, and one of the fortunate things is that the facilitation works both ways. That is, as one grows, the circle of compassion also grows.
Right.
But what one finds with these practices is that there is a phenomenon of what the Buddhists call breaking down the barriers. That is, as one practices compassion, that quality of mind, and I believe this is true of healthy qualities of mind in general, tends to break down those divisions, and the mind naturally tends to fall open in wider and wider circles.
Yeah.
Now, this is used very skillfully in some of the compassion practices. In which
you mean we move to higher perspectives?
Yes, more encompassing perspectives, yes. So that the difference between, for example, friend and enemy tends to dissolve in really intense compassion when one's doing compassion practices in retreat, and compassion becomes, as it can be, extraordinarily powerful, ecstatic emotion, then enemies, you know, cease to be such.
Well, here's now, first of all, I fundamentally agree with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. This is nitpicking at the edge of theory, and that's the relation between states and stages, as mm-hmm. we talk about, and that I think people can indeed have that experience. But if you take somebody who's at egocentric level of development, is at a first-person perspective, a pre-operational cognition, they can have an experience of kind of fusion with others. But if you ask them to actually take the perspective of a single other person, they can't do it. But what does seem to happen, which certainly fits with what you're saying, is that the more you have those kinds of experiences, the more rapidly you move through these developmental scales. So even a person who is at egocentric, red, preoperational cognition, who cannot cognitively even take the role of other, that the more they have those experiences, the more rapidly they're going to be able to move into that and actually take an ethnocentric perspective. And the more they do those things, the more rapidly they'll be able to take a world-centric perspective. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think there's a... You can't skip stages.
No.
And I don't know any evidence that even these ecstatic experiences let you do that.
I agree with you theoretically, and I agree with you experientially. That's certainly my own experience in doing those practices has been that the contemplative traditions, the world's great spiritual traditions, have these extraordinary practices for inducing quite remarkable states of love and compassion, for example. And I've been humbled to find that when I come out of retreat, just how far back I regress.
Yeah.
48 hours later, I can be snapping at my wife. So, you're my most beloved, so let alone the people I don't like.
The rest of us get treated, yes. But I think what we're finding is how both of them can be true, in the sense that you get into these states that are extremely authentic and very real. We're not saying they're not real. It's just that they also do push against one's stages and help one move. The Western studies that development has showed us is that since you can't skip stages, that even though in meditation you think you're levitating and flying through air, when we actually check it out, it turns out you're not doing that. Doesn't mean you're not in an exalted state, you are. But that we put these two together and say the more you experience these states of boundless love and compassion, that whatever stage you're at is going to help you move to the next stage more quickly. We have some pretty good evidence on that. The Skip Alexander and Suzanne Kuhn-Reuter studies are very suggestive, and that meditation does exactly that. Whatever stage you're at, it helps you move more rapidly to those stages. It doesn't help you skip stages. Mm. And stages of development, first, second, third, fourth, fifth person perspectives, are an easy way to think about the five orders of consciousness, for example, with the capacity to take those number of perspectives. And so meditation and experiencing these states helps us move through these stages. And I think that's another ethical imperative as well, is that since moving to higher stages has a normative capacity to it, if we're saying that somehow ethics is the greatest good for the greatest number, or as I would refer it much more technically, the greater depth for the greatest span, that taking more perspectives into account is an ethical normative injunction.
Yeah. And a practice.
And a practice, absolutely.
All these things are practices, and they come slowly.
Yeah.
They come very slowly.
So we drifted. I pushed us back into theory where we were doing some practicalities, and so that was one example of getting into these practice experience of love and compassion.
Right, that's one in daily life. The great traditions have a variety of compassion and ethical practices. We could look at them in different categories. There are visualization practices. There are practices which use repetition of particular phrases. We could think of them as a kind of spiritual cognitive therapy. Taking, for example, one of the simplest of all the recitation practices, simply whenever you see someone suffering, repeating a phrase such as, may you be free of pain and sorrow. And this is one I've worked with quite a bit, and I've found it quite wonderful that after a while, it goes from rote repetition to a truly felt desire. Oh, may this person really be free of pain and sorrow.
Right.
And may I be an instrument for helping them. And then something wonderful begins to happen. For me, it's just beginning, but I can see the possibility that would become an automatic, spontaneous response. And that is, I'll see someone in pain, and that thought will just rise automatically. I think that, of course, is the general direction in which all these practices go, from something which is a rote technical procedure to a spontaneous, automatic, felt, emotionally congruent response in any situation.
Yeah.
So that is a very simple one I think any of us can use in a situation. It can be done in anything, of course, from daily life, whenever you see someone in pain,
right,
or may you be free of pain and sorrow, or it can be done, for example, in intensive retreat practice, and there are retreats in which people literally do that from the moment you wake up to the moment you fall asleep for weeks or months.
Right.
And then it becomes quite remarkably impactful practice.
Right.
As you say, state with its limitations, but still better than many of the states.
Well, and these also are habits of mind that are trans-level. So in other words, the habit, the capacity you develop, even if it's developed within the limits of your present level, is a skill that you can take with you to higher levels and will serve you well. So even though you might have a limited perspective when you develop a particular skill, it's still a skill that you've set that you can take with you as you expand into more and more perspectives, into greater spheres of care and consciousness and concern. So it's not that just because you learn something at a particular level doesn't mean it doesn't have benefit at others, and same as through your state training.
And I want to mention again another practice which is very closely aligned to something we were talking about before, and that's right company, let's call it, community or relationship. You know, when I was working on the book Essential Spirituality, I spent 3 years basically researching the world's traditions, looking at what were the qualities that they all agreed on were most important, and what practices did they have for cultivating them. And the thing which surprised me most in those 3 years was that each and every one of the great traditions said, for each and every one of the qualities they all regard as important, if you want to develop this capacity, hang out with people who have it.
Yeah.
And that's certainly true for ethics and compassion.
Yeah.
You know, consciousness is catchy.
Yeah.
And so hang out with the people who
have it.
Have it. Yeah, right. As you said, if they'll put up with you. But certainly, right contact, having role models, exemplars.
Yeah.
We were conversing earlier, and you pointed out that how important heroes or role models are at each level. And I hadn't thought of the fact that it's important at each level.
Yeah.
And I was talking with a mutual friend of ours, John O'Neill, recently, who has written on leadership and excellence.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was very eager to know what he'd found in his research. What fosters excellence?
Yeah.
What fosters leadership? And what he said was having a variety of mentors across the life cycle.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
That's
Here's a man who's studied this for a lifetime.
Yeah.
You ask him, what's the most important thing you've said? And his answer, having a variety of exemplars and
mentors. Fascinating.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, too, doesn't it? I mean, it makes sense. So as we go through some of the remaining points that I wanted to touch with you, do you keep in mind some of the practical examples that come to mind about this? Because I know you've got just hundreds of them, because you have spent an awful lot of time looking at this. And so any of those that come up, let's be sure and touch bases with those. I want to give an example of something that always struck me. It's a very simple practice, but it's a Quaker practice. I've mentioned it several times, but I like it because even though it's just focusing on one aspect of ethics, it's very, very effective, and it always catches people up. But it also points out that it's something that, in a sense, by drawing on your own resources, you can get in touch with a certain ethical moment. And that is, it's a simple practice. It's very common in Quaker gatherings. And that is that they would have a period of time that they would set aside, and they would say, basically, during this period, let the next words out of your mouth reflect the wisdom of the very highest self you can find. And it's a very, very straightening exercise. You get very straight, and you really, really allow and search within. And particularly in a group exercise, it's very, very profound. And what I like about it is, you had said earlier that you would help people find ways that they can intuit and feel their way into the ethical thing to do at a given moment. Because part of the whole point about ethics is, it's certainly the case that in many cases you have to, in a sense, learn certain ethical behavior. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's almost every tradition, and including right up to today with Immanuel Kant and going all the way back to Plato, is an idea that some deep component of ethics is something that's available to your highest self if you know where to look. And that's a very, very important fact. You know, we talked about the importance of taking perspectives into account, most certainly, and doing the true and useful thing in regard to others. But it's also, in some sense, know thyself and know the highest ethics that this self can tell you. And if there are levels of self, and there are, then at the very least, it's also the case that maybe if I'm only at ethnocentric level of self, if I look within real hard, I'll find a world-centric self.
Yes.
And if I look within that, I'll find a cosmocentric self.
Yes.
And so it's a wonderful, even with that, way to really draw on whatever highest resources. The fact is that we do have resources with them. Mm-hmm. At whatever stage of development, that represents the highest ethics we're capable of at that moment. And the ethical thing is not to do the ethical thing according to the one and only way to do an ethical. There's no one absolute, this is the ethical thing to do. It's whatever is the very highest act you're capable of for the greatest depth, the greatest span, do that. That's the ethical thing to do at this moment. I cannot tell somebody who's at a red altitude or egocentric level of development, I'm going to measure your ethics like a world-centric person would do. And that's what we were saying earlier, for somebody who's egocentric, you ought to be ashamed of that. It is a good rule of thumb. And if the person says, I should be ashamed of that, that's, you know, the ethics we're saying is you have to be very state-specific to these as well. And one size fits all is something we'd be careful about. I'd like to kind of finish this by focusing on what might be the most difficult aspect of ethics, both practically and theoretically. And that is that the kind of ethics that we've been talking about, the problems of ethics that we've been talking about up to this point, are almost entirely involved with intentionality and will. In other words, we've assumed that we all know the right thing to do. And the thing that we've been talking about is the difficulty of doing it. In other words, I should act intentional by this, I should go ahead and do this, I should be ethical because if I function better, I should be ethical because I operate at a higher level. Or if I'm thinking about ethical activity, it's for the betterment of beings, I think somebody's suffering, I want to remove the suffering. But when we get right down to what's the actual discernment mechanism, and here almost one of the ways of really clarifying this is to think about lifeboat ethics. And here is where it gets really difficult. And most people know what a lifeboat ethics situation is, which is it's just a thought experiment, a theoretical what-if situation, which is imagine that you're the captain of a lifeboat. Basically, the ship's gone down. You're the captain. There are 10 people in the boat. The boat is only designed for 5, so it can hold 7 at most. So you have to throw 3 people overboard, or all 10 are going to die. Now, anybody can say, I want the betterment of all beings. May all suffering cease. Now, yeah, we got that. Now, which 3 are you going to throw overboard? And all of a sudden, all of the sort of grand sentiments fail you. And not that they're not there, they're absolutely crucial. But now it comes down to the discernment, one way or another, of judgment. And this is where ethics gets very, very intense. And not only do you have to do this pragmatically, how would you do it, but then you get into the theoretical, and then what is the justification? How do you justify what the choices are? Now, the reason I want to bring this up is lifeboat ethics is, if you just think of that, is the kind of experiment I like to recommend that people do in addition to the others, because it forces us to use the kind of judgment meter that this culture has dismantled. And so under those circumstances, you very soon find yourself getting involved in things that demand some discernment of depth, one way or another. But depth isn't the only thing that needs to be concerned. It's developmental depth or any other kind of depth. And that is if I find, for example, that there's somebody who is highly, highly developed, highly, highly realized, but they might be 87 years old. They might be one of the 3 that go out of the boat. So it can't just be depth in any isolated way. It's a whole awful contextual situation with many, many other factors that go into this decision. If somebody's young, does that count? If they're quite ill, does that count? And so on. And it's these kinds of decisions that you find yourself really having to run through all the implicit hidden judgments you're making anyway. Put them on the table and start to make some difficult decisions. Now, I don't really have or think that a person has to come up with any absolute answers to any of this. It's just think about it. It's just one of those classical things, think about it. Because all of life's real decisions are lifeboat ethics. That's the damnable thing about real life, is that they're all lifeboat ethics decisions, and that's what makes them so very, very, very hard. And if we could all end world hunger and make peace and make everybody happy, got it. Now let's get back to reality, and the fact of the matter is I have 2 types of ethical problems I'm faced with. One is I can't even engage my will to do the general ethical thing of thinking about other people's suffering, like we were talking about. So do exercises that help you just do that. Get your ethical ass engaged, because there's a higher hedonism and a higher pleasure and a higher functioning and a higher consciousness that follows the ethical grain, because there is an eros to the cosmos and ethics is involved in following that. And then the second one, though, is that so many of the practicalities life to life and day to day, it's lifeboat ethics. And that's the second kind of discernment that we're called to make. It's very hard to make. As the first one is hard to engage will, this is hard to engage judgment. And so simply thinking about that just exercises that part of the mind that has to look at these kinds of judgments. Now, lifeboat ethics is also a very, it's just one slice of a kind of ethics, because, as you know, I believe that there's a fundamental, basic moral intuition that all sentient beings have and all human beings have. They unpack it at whatever level of development they're at, and that generates the different kinds of morals and ethical principles at the different levels of development. But the basic moral intuition is essentially the same, and that's to protect and promote the greatest depth for the greatest span. And of course, it'll be as a person understands it at their level. So if you're at a level that has only one perspective, then the greatest depth is whatever promotes me. But certainly, by the time we get to world-centric and higher levels, it takes on a much broader meaning, the same basic moral intuition. But the greatest depth for the greatest span, so it's not really the greatest good for the greatest number, because good is the undefined category in the utilitarian argument, and it's been shot to pieces, not just by Stuart Mill's statement about better to be an unhappy Socrates than a contented pig. But we replace good with a notion of depth, because depth is a vertical dimension, and so the greatest depth for the greatest span, again, you get in an almost lifeboat ethics kind of thing. There is no calculus for how to do this, because what's best served if you want the greatest depth for the greatest span? Would you say 10 Siberian tigers or Al Capone? 10 Siberian tigers, I would. So it's that kind of thing. But again, there's no absolute correct answer to this. It's a delicate balance and judgment of a million factors that come into it. But I do think the greatest depth of the greatest span is the single simplest way to state what a fundamental normative injunction is. And it takes both a horizontal component of the greatest number into account, but a vertical component of the greater depth and the greater degree of care and consciousness that the sentient being itself is expressing. So the greater intrinsic value. That's sort of the general thought, but the idea in the lifeboat ethics is, again, it's a narrow slice of ethics, but it's something that we have to think about. Another reason it's narrow is that it doesn't take into account the span here. So it might be that one person might not seem to have much intrinsic value themselves, but they might be really intrinsic to a whole network. They might be a physician in a ghetto taking care of thousands of people, and that would be a great deal of worth to them, above the worth that they're might have themselves. So they have a much greater span that they're helping. So that's not taken into account necessarily if you're just looking at the life of ethics thing. So that's kind of my rambling sort of attempt to get that gestalt on that topic into place. But one way or another, lifeboat ethics is the fascinating topic, isn't it, in terms of just engaging the serpent, the judgment.
Well, I think it's usefully humbling. As I was listening to you, I was rethinking what I'd been saying during our conversation and realizing, yes, in the nitty-gritty of life and lifeboat ethics, some of these ideas are diminished, shall we say. Reality has a way of intruding on nice theories. And I think it also points to a very important fact, and that is, we can think about this as much as we want and we can try to access our intuition, but there are some problems which are just extraordinary and they're difficult.
Yeah.
And as you said, there may be, who are we to judge that there's any one right answer to any of these things?
No.
And it's just very useful to be humble in the light of the enormity of human suffering and the complexity of problems and the apparent insolubility of many.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's a very useful perspective.
Yeah. And the thing that I find most useful about lifeboat ethics is feel it exercising a muscle, even though you're never going to arrive at just an absolute clear answer. Mm-hmm. So it's just a kind of judgment that you know is important to be able to make. I mean, first of all, you might be called upon to make something just that catastrophically difficult, but we're making those kinds of small decisions all the time anyway.
Yes, that's a good point. It's actually a good metaphor for life, because we have to make decisions anyway.
Yes.
And the reality is we never really know.
No, and I don't think there is a right answer to it. There are a lot of bad answers. There are a lot of really bad answers. And I don't mean to pick on anybody's, I'll just do this as a crank thing, but if you've got seven Hell's Angels and three Bodhisattvas, and you throw the Bodhisattvas out, bad answer to the lifeboat thing. So, but in terms of just there is one precise answer to this, there isn't. And the same as the greatest depth for the greatest span has no one simple answer. There are many almost equivalent answers, and some are very similar. And certainly in the lifeboat ethics thing, I don't think there's any clear one answer to this. But I do know it's making ethical judgments is as good as making the true good and the beautiful. This is one of the three fundamental kinds of judgments that we are called upon to make in life. And because there is no one simple answer to it, doesn't mean that we're not called upon to make those judgments, because we are all the time. And if we're not doing it explicitly, we're doing it implicitly. We're making these judgments, either pretending we're not, or we let it slide. And the judgments get made unconsciously, which happens a lot. And then you end up talking to Francis Vaughan because you've got a lot of problems therapeutically. So just exercise that muscle, thinking about it. Think about who you put in, who would you throw out, what are the criteria that you use. Just a good experiment to make it helps clarify these things enormously. And it does point out the fact that these are the kinds of things we're called upon all the time. And making that kind of judgment is not far removed from really fundamental things that we're going through. Because when you can make those kinds of judgments, they're the kinds of things that can facilitate your own growth and development. Because the deeper and better the judgment you make, we've already said that higher levels of development are marked by more perspectives and greater degrees of ethical goodness. And so that is also tied up with being able to make these kinds of judgments in the face of never knowing the exactly correct answer, because not only is there probably not one, but even if there is, we can't know it, probably.
Yes, yes.
So
again, we come back to the tolerance of ambiguity and of not knowing.
And I think on the relative side of the street, ambiguity, and on the absolute side of the street, great mystery. And I think that might be a perfect place to end.
Yes, end, let us end in mystery, from where we began. May I just quote Houston Smith, we are born in mystery, we live in mystery, and we die in mystery.
Thank you, Roger.
You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.